I wanted to begin by just reflecting a little bit on some contrasts in how Nietzsche and Marx deal with the relation of universal in particular. Now, much of Marx's discussion in his early writings revolves around how modern society, or modern times, are characterized by a bifurcation between a political domain in which individuals interact as citizens, pursuing allegedly universal goals, and operating in a role that is concerned with determining the whole to which they all belong and all presumably exercising equal political right. And then you have a domain called civil society, which is supposed to be subordinate to the political domain, a domain in which individuals interact in terms of particularity, particular needs of various sorts. Now, Marx's criticisms, which are tied to his criticisms of religion, are that this realm of universality is actually not supreme, and in fact illusory, because not only is it subordinate to civil society and the pursuits of particular interests defining civil society, but the particular interests of civil society end up being dominated by the interests of capital. And those interests, in a sense, make the state something subordinate to those particular ends. And that, in this respect, individuals find themselves subordinate to relations of domination in which their universal being as humans, their species being, is something that is, shall we say, alienated from their actual existence, which is prey to the rule of the particular and the particularity that is not their own. Marx, nonetheless, presents a kind of solution, which in a way is going to eliminate and overcome this illusory bifurcation of this universal domain and the particular domain that has undermined this distinction between state and civil society. And in some respect, establish a domain of activity in which individuals' pursuits of need and production will be undertaken in a way that is somehow universal, either in terms of a universal association of all who will somehow or other co-determine all of these affairs, instead of engaging in a life of citizenry that operates as a beyond, over and above this domain in which the real particular existence, in which we're concerned with labor and satisfying our needs, transpires. Now, Nietzsche equally, in a sense, objects to the universalities. The universalities that reason pursues on the part of those philosophers who, well, maybe all philosophers, privilege conceptual determination as what provides unique access to the character of what is. This is regarded as leaving out the particular to which change and becoming is related, to which sensuality is related, to which our bodily existence is tied, to which everything natural is associated. And the appeal to the universal, which, as we'll see, is also something Nietzsche will see as central to the morality that he is going to be pillaring in the way in which he pillories the philosophy pioneered by the likes of Socrates. That moralizing equally privileges a universality that is illusory, because it is really something that not only presupposes the particular, but is itself a function of a particular form of life, and therefore belies its very own origin, its very own character. It's fundamentally a lie. It's fundamentally mendacious, as he will say. But for Nietzsche, the remedy does not consist in somehow erecting a universality that is going to be unbeholden to particularity or be merged with particularity. No, it's going to be a matter of not attempting to rehabilitate or reaffirm universality in any respect, but to instead advance the particular as such, and to do so with no holds barred. And to regard the attempts to do what Marx will be concerned with as being just another attempt to flee to a universality that is illusory and mendacious. Now, I want to pursue these themes by looking at, are there any questions about this kind of way of perhaps thinking of how Nietzsche might stand in connection to at least the young Marx? Now, what I want us to do is to turn to some of the central discussions of morality that Nietzsche presents us with as we move into Twilight of the Idols. And I think you can see that the nature of the discussion is very much parallel to the way in which Nietzsche addresses reason and philosophy and addresses the case of Socrates. Now, he begins in this section, which is entitled entitled Morality as Anti-Natural, by suggesting and by perhaps giving you the sense that morality as such is anti-nature. We have this discussion titled Morality as Anti-Nature. But you will see that Nietzsche will also speak about there being a morality that is a naturalism, and a morality that just in certain respects he will be affirming, or seeming to endorse. So just as Nietzsche is going to be, in a certain respect, presenting us with what might appear to be a blanket attack on philosophy, and a blanket attack on any engagement of reasoning, he at times is going to speak of himself as being a kind of philosopher. So too, when you hear addresses and critiques morality as something that is anti-nature, he's also going to affirm a different kind of morality, an alternative that will be regarded as a kind of naturalism. And we want to see to what degree Nietzsche can affirm a kind of naturalistic morality in opposition to the morality he criticizes, and whether, by the same token, he can affirm a kind of philosophizing with a hammer, that can, in any respect, overcome the kind of dilemmas that he wields or unmasks in regard to the philosophizing that he is going to be repudiating. Now, in speaking about morality as anti-nature, Nietzsche is characterizing morality in very much the way in which he characterizes the kind of reason that attempts to identify true being with what is universal. Just as that kind of reasoning, left out of account, life, with all its becoming change and individuality, so too, in a sense, morality, the morality that is anti-nature, operates as a way of, in a sense, stripping value, and in fact, stripping value from everything that might be considered to be particular and sensuous, and not only stripping any value from it, but in a way regarding it as being the antithesis of value, as being what could be considered evil. Now, this involves an attempt to extirpate the passions, an attempt to extirpate desire, an attempt to, in a sense, eliminate everything pertaining to what could be considered the bodily dimension of individual existence. And this involves, in a sense, a hostility, Nietzsche claims, a hostility to life itself. Now, one might say, so what? Why should life be honored? Why should we bow down to life if we are in a position to overcome aspects of life? Well, we want to see in what way Nietzsche grounds the critical bent of what he's presenting here. One way is to do something very similar to how he directed a kind of ad hominem critique to Socrates. Just as he tried to root the appeal to reason in Socrates, in the character of Socrates, in a certain kind of condition. So too here, the moral enterprise of extirpating passions is here presented as being rooted in a particular condition. Now, in the case of Socrates, what was the condition that, in a way, would lead someone to privilege reason?
He was physically repugnant, and he was part of the plebs, according to Nietzsche.
Yeah, which meant what with regard to the way in which he, in a sense, was compelled to privilege reason because of who he is, and because of what is particular about him.
He was repelled by the particularness of himself.
Well, also, he wasn't, I mean, his particularity was such that it could not assert itself over and against those whose particularity made them the powerful, the masters. Only by appealing to reason could he undermine their given natural supremacy by asking all to submit to the tribunal of reason, a tribunal which is not concerned with valuing the particular, but rather with robbing particularity of any independent value by demanding that which is universal, that which can be a principle as being the source of what is normative, yes.
In critiquing Socrates like he's doing, in critiquing the favoring of reason and dialectic, is he in favor of like a natural selection between what people, particular people, should be dominant and which people should be the plebs? Or is he just like critiquing the way Socrates goes about?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're gonna...
I mean, like, is he in favor of some kind of natural selection within our species?
Well, I think there are two texts that bear directly upon this, one of which we'll look at today, one of which we'll look at next time. The text today has to do with this discussion of the improvers of mankind, where Nietzsche distinguishes between two kinds of improvers. One kind of improver attempts to tame humanity. And the tamers of humanity are identified by Nietzsche with, well, in particular, Christian morality, to which he contrasts those who attempt to improve mankind by appealing to breeding, and those who appeal to breeding are represented in this case by the laws of Manu of ancient Hinduism, which advocates a caste society where individuals are bred in the sense that by birth they belong to different castes to which different roles are presented, in which one has privileges based upon, you could say, one's birthright. And this is presented as being, well, something that has a kind of affirmative value in contrast to the tamers of mankind who want to, in a sense, weaken the natural advantages of individuals and make them sick in the way which animals could be said to be sickened by their confinement in zoos and the like. That's one text, and we'll look at that. Another one is a text later on in the readings for today called Anti-Darwin, where Nietzsche specifically addresses natural selection and critiques Darwin for in a sense, imposing Malthusian ideas on nature. And of course, Darwin does directly appeal to Malthus as a way of setting up the process of natural selection by indicating, as Malthus did with regard to human population, that the geometric explosion of population growth would mean that not all members of the species are going to be able to survive and reproduce. There's necessarily going to be a struggle for survival. And then if there are differences, those differences that are superior in their adaptation to the demands of survival in the particular environment faced by organisms, well, those creatures that have those superior adaptations are going to prevail and reproduce, pass them on, et cetera. Well, Nietzsche will have some remarks about that, which bear upon this. So let's put that question off for the time being. But you know, obviously, we have this question of what is going to be, what is it that Nietzsche is going to be affirming, and on what basis can he affirm anything, given the nature of his criticism? Well, here he's making a kind of ad hominem criticism against those who are presenting a morality that is anti-nature, that is hostile to life in the sense of wanting to extirpate the passions, wanting as much as possible contain the sensual embodiment of individuals. And here, he on the one hand wants to point out that whole drive to uphold the morality of this character is rooted in a very specific condition. It's a condition of individuals who are, as he says, too weak-willed, too degenerate to be able to impose moderation on themselves. They cannot in any way control their passions. And indeed, there's something about their passions that makes them, as he says, stupid. There's a certain stupidity to passions. They can be in conflict with one another in various ways. But here we have individuals who lack any type of control, so there's no halfway solution for them. Their only solution is to drive to extirpate the passions in general, because they can't control them in any particular way and hold on to some as opposed to others. And that is reflected in their radical, in their deadly hostility against centralization or against sensuality. Now, note, this hostility to the passions is going to be tied to other features as well. That is, conduct is going to be asked to submit to something other than the hold of the passions, other than a matter of abiding by one's instincts, abiding by what is natural. It will involve something that could be considered, well, from the point of view of those who offer this morality, a spiritualized existence where what had been the play of instincts and passions now takes the form of a love that is to be directed to all, right? A kind of universal love, a kind of universal regard for others. And Nietzsche contrasts this with a kind of morality that is a naturalism. And I want to look briefly at how he describes this. This he does on 489. Here he says that there is a healthy morality. No, the other morality, the morality that is concerned with turning against sensuality, turning against passion, turning against the body, turning against particular differences, is contrasted. And that, of course, note, he speaks of as being degenerate, unhealthy. It's that to which individuals appeal who can't control their passions in any respect and have passions that are in some respect conflicted. Well, we have opposing this as the opposite morality is that which is a naturalism because it does not rebel against the instincts of life. It is rather nothing other than expression of instincts of life. and not instincts of life that could be said to be hostile to life. And Nietzsche points out that, in a way, the commandments of life involve a determinate canon of what thou shalt and what thou shalt not. That this, in some respect, is endemic to life. Now, an anti-natural morality turns against the commandments that are built into a life that abides by its instincts. Now note, in speaking about that turn against the instincts of life, that very turn is rooted in a form of life. And Nietzsche lays out these aspects in a discussion that follows, where he brings up something very similar to what he brought up in his attack on Socrates. And that is that this morality that puts itself forward as anti-natural, which is concerned with extirpating the instincts, which in the case of the degenerates are instincts of individuals that they can't in any way control, there's something mendacious in this revolt against life. What is a mendacious element in this revolt against life? And a mendaciousness that involves not only an illusion, but also a futility, an absurdity. First of all, what is mendacious about it? Or illusory about it? Or deceiving about it?
You can't really do it, and so you end up spiritualizing the struggle against it. And
well, when you say you can't do it, what can't you do?
You can't pluck out your eyes, he refers to. You can't stop them. You can't really resist them. All you can do is maybe spiritualize them.
Yeah, but in a sense, you can attempt to... fight against instincts as prescribed by this type of moral advocacy. But in doing it, what are you not able to do?
You can't really be free to be yourself in accordance with your instincts.
Well, in some respect, you are being yourself in doing this, because this, Nietzsche wants to say, is an expression of your decadent condition. So note, it is a particular condition that is wielding its anti-natural crusade against what might be considered the condition that it is not, which is equally a particular condition. It puts itself forward as if it is against passions in general, against life in general. But it is, in a sense, attacking a particular form of life. The life that might be said to be represented by the morality that is a naturalism. A morality that is not attempting to contain the instincts of life. So here we have something that, on the one hand, is attempting to fully spiritualize morality and have it, in a sense, operate independently of what one is by nature and everything wrapped up in sensuality. It can't do that because it itself is an expression of a particular type of sensuality, a particular type of physiological condition. And although it presents itself as being completely free and turning its back entirely on life, it is itself an expression of a particular form of life. And what it is attacking is not life in general, but the particular form of life that it does not share. So in this regard, it is mendacious. It's claiming to be something that is fully spiritualized, fully independent of any particular physical condition. And it can't make itself independent of all physical condition, because it itself is simply an expression of that. And this, in a sense, is tied up with a claim that Nietzsche makes about life itself. He says that life itself forces us to posit values. The entire effort to engage in evaluation, to engage in in putting forward norms, which Nietzsche earlier has said really can't be done in any impartial way. That is, we can't estimate the value of life in the sense that we think we're doing, namely as if we were standing outside of life. We can't do that. Whenever we are engaged in justification or putting forward values, we are doing it as an expression of what we are, what kind of a life we represent, what particular form of life we represent. So all value positing it, be it values of having to do with knowledge, where one is engaged in adjudicating between what is true and what is false, or values concerning morality, where we're concerned with distinguishing between right and wrong, or values in the aesthetic domain concerning what is beautiful or ugly, all are, in a sense, rooted in a form of life, not independent of that, and thereby relative to that form of life in particular. Now the question is, why should life be thought of as being bound up with value positing, the putting forward of values? Why would that be? Nietzsche makes that claim. And why would life itself involve that? But what is the character of life as commonly recognized as something that, in a sense, could be characteristic of life in contrast to what is not alive? What does everything that is alive do? Well, it sustains itself. It repairs itself. It attempts to deal with its environment in such a way as to survive. It engages in metabolism. In a certain sense, it contains a process that is concerned with upholding itself, with perpetuating itself. In a sense, it is something that is an end in itself. Maintaining itself is the value built into life, right? Because it is an active process to do just that, and that process is guided, in a way, by the norm consisting in sustaining itself, positing itself, over and against what is outside it. Now, when Nietzsche speaks about positing of values, he's going to bring in a term that pops up every once in a while called the will to power. And you might ask yourself, well, how does the positing of value involve a will to power? Now, power can be looked upon as a self-assertion, right? And life has self-assertion built into it. But power might also be thought of as not just self-assertion, but a self-assertion over others. Now, you might ask yourself, in what respect does the positing of value involve a self-assertion over others? Because we find that throughout the discussion. That is, those who Socrates wields dialectic against are engaged in a self-assertion, by means of which they just happen to lord over others. The dialecticians are, in a sense, asserting themselves in such a way that in putting forward the value of reason, reason is going to be employed so that the hoi polloi, the rabble, the lower echelons, are going to be able to dominate the rest. What is it about values and the positive values that's tied to, in a sense, a will to power?
Judgment formation.
Well, what does judgment formation have to do with a power over others? Or what is it about value? What's the character of value? Yes.
None of these values exist in a vacuum, and they don't exist in the realm of dialectic. They exist in, like, the agora. So one of them will be an operation, like sort of an operative form in society, and whichever one is has been willed to power by a stronger.
But I think you have to think about value itself, its character. Because a value is not just a passion. It's not just a desire, an urge. Right? A value, in a sense, has built into it a kind of universality. Because a value is a norm. A norm that, in a way, is going to be something to which all should subscribe. Now, if life involves a self-assertion, it involves a positing of values. It involves positing something that is a self-assertion that equally involves a power play. That is a submission of others to the norm that will serve the self-assertion of the life form that is positing it. In a sense, that's what all norms turn out to be if one recognizes that all norms, which are universal standards by definition, cannot be justified by reason, cannot be said to be rooted in nature, in the sense that nature has these universal principles, but rather that this norm is rooted in a particular nature, a particular type of life, a particular condition. So that even though in the case of, Socrates and the anti-natural moralists, norms will be put forward that are alleged to be universal and alleged not to be conditioned upon a particular perspective or a particular form of life. They come from a particular form of life. They can't be justified by reason. Why are they there? They're there because that type of individual has willed them, has affirmed them, has put them forward, and willed them because of who they are. There's something arbitrary in a way about that. Because after all, if you can't provide a rational justification of these norms, they're still put forward. In being put forward, they're being put forward arbitrarily. Whoever's put them forward has chosen to put them forward. In putting them forward as norms, they're putting forward something to which all are to be held accountable. So in positing values or norms, one is in effect making a power play. One is engaged in an exercise of a will to power. And this is going to be true of every positing of value, and this is going to be basic to life. If we regard life as, on the one hand, involving a self-assertion, that as a self-assertion requires asserting oneself in face of what is other than oneself. Because a living organism has to sustain itself in face of its environment. Well, this has implications then for this anti-natural morality. It can't free itself from life. It is an expression of life. And yet, it operates as if it were not an expression of life and puts itself forward as if it were not an expression of life. And the key to that is the very claim that it's telling us to be something we ought to be. Something we ought to be. How does this appeal to be what we ought to be? Or one might even say to improve ourselves in general. It involves the fundamental mendaciousness underlying this anti-natural morality. What does this appeal to an ought? That has as its counterpart the appeal to the beyond of the universality of thought, which is beyond to the sensuous reality of that blooming, buzzing domain of becoming that Nietzsche has told us is what is really real, not the apparent world. Well, how does the appeal to norms that are specifying what we ought to be, something that involves the same kind of mendaciousness? Well, we can't be what we ought to be. We can only be what we are. And we are, on this diagnosis, a particular form of life of one sort or another, which is why Nietzsche will say later on, you know, if you consider the appeal to self-interest, well, what matters is what kind of self are we talking about? To some degree, the appeal to self-interest is tied to the self-assertion of life in general. But if there are these differences in forms of life, then their self-assertion might be regarded as having different rankings. Now, when we speak of these differences, of course, we have to ask ourselves, how is a ranking to be made? Who is to sit in judgment and rank different forms of life? How, for instance, are we to say that the moralizers who want us to extirpate our passions are decadent, This is their form of life. It's one form of life among others. And to some degree, they succeed. They succeed in dominating others. They succeed, in a way, in overturning the values that are built into those who will draw a distinction between good and bad in terms of simply asserting who they are in function of their instincts, which may give them a certain kind of natural predominance, where those set of values now become overturned by an appeal to what is good and evil, where evil now becomes associated with what those who follow natural instincts regard as good. This is now regarded to be evil through this inversion of values. Well, both are expressions of life. Both might be said to be expressions of will to power. Why should one be regarded with contempt and the other, in some respect, endorsed? What appears to be the only factor that Nietzsche brings in to really, shall we say, favor one as opposed to the other?
His criterion is life, which all of life, all of its forms, all of its messiness and sensuous demands. Oh, and those who affirm those demands.
Now, again, when you say life being the criteria, you know, life comes in multiple forms. If we're just talking about life, it might appear to be completely indifferent to all these forms. He uses another kind of distinction, which is tied to life in a certain way, but what is it? It figures throughout, and has been here from the outset. Health. The healthy life as opposed to the unhealthy life. The healthy as opposed to the degenerate. Right? Well, what is a healthy life? What is sickness? I mean, sickness is a part of life, after all. Just as death is a part of life. But what is health in respect to life? It is measured by life, right? What does it mean to be healthy as opposed to sick?
You're functioning as you biologically should.
Yeah, I mean, what is the element of shouldness here when you speak of...
It's a deprivation, it's a disease, it's a subtraction.
I mean, a disease in a certain respect inconsistent with or incompatible with the fully functioning of the organism. Whereas health is a matter of, in a way, having operations that are consistently reaffirming the self as life, you know, is in a sense always striving on its own. So we're talking about a kind of internal consistency. We're not appealing to any standards outside of life. And any attempt to think that one could appeal to such standards for Nietzsche is going to be illusory. Because all attempts to engage in evaluating, positing norms, justification, are performed by someone whose actions of value positing, of engaging in the kind of normative engagements that, shall we say, are traditionally what are identified with what it means to be a rational agent. All of these are actually rooted in this life process, which itself is particular in character. So note, the only kind of distinction that he can make use of and does make use of is that between what is healthy and what is unhealthy. What is consistent with as opposed to what is inconsistent with life. What is hostile versus what is at one with life. So the appeal to be what one ought to, these are all matters that involve the same kind of hostility. Now, I wanted to just right now leap beyond the section on the four great errors. We'll turn to that later. But I want us to just look at the section on the improvers of mankind, since the question is brought up regarding, well, what is Nietzsche favoring here? Is he favoring a kind of Darwinian struggle where, in a sense, we want not to help the weak, but to let the strong prevail and let that struggle go its merry way? Well, in the improvers of mankind, Nietzsche is speaking about this whole drive to improve mankind, and pointing to it as something that might be regarded as what above all has been called morality. And under the heading of the improvers of mankind, he gives us these two types, those who are the tamers and those who are the breeders. It might appear that both of them, as improvers of mankind, are going to be repudiated by Nietzsche. But obviously, given the rhetoric with which he clothes his discussions of these two types of improvers, and by the way, this is on page 501 following, he obviously is showing his scorn for the tamers and showing a certain kind of admiration for the breeders. Now, the tamers are obviously concerned with restraining the instincts of what is given by nature to individuals. And the goal of the tamers is to come up with a tamed individual. And the tamers are identified here by Nietzsche as the priests, and in particular, the Christian priests, who are going to be taming, for example, the wild pagan Teutons, seducing them into a monastery, making them sinners, putting them in a cage involving all sorts of concepts that are foisted upon them, which are going to make them themselves full of hatred for the very springs of life that they have, to be suspicious against everything that could be considered their very own strength and the very happiness that they have. In short, as Nietzsche says, to make them into a Christian, a tamed human being. And note the term he applies to the tamed human being. It's a sick human being. It's a sick human being, right? Once again, he's using these antitheses of health and the lack of health. Well, the tamed individual is sickened. Their natural strengths, their natural happiness and the like is sapped, is regarded by them, insofar as they're tamed, as being something evil, as being something with which sin is to be associated. And to do that, a whole bevy of certain concepts have to be introduced. And as we'll see, one of the principal concepts that has to be introduced is nothing other than the concept of free will, which Nietzsche will associate with Christian doctrine, both original sin and the sense of freedom in general, because with freedom comes the imputing of responsibility to individuals. And with imputing of responsibility comes what other factor? You can be punished if you're responsible. You can also be guilty and feel guilt-ridden for being responsible. Now, Nietzsche is associating all of these concepts that one might think are basic to any morality whatsoever with the specific morality of taming. And we want to consider, well, how could one possibly dispense with these concepts and retain any kind of value positive whatsoever? And if so, what are we endorsing? Or what are we left with? Well, to some degree, we see what we're left with, or to some degree, what an alternative might be if we turn to the breeders who are improving mankind by breeding them. And the breeding then is a breeding them into particular races and kinds. Now you might ask, why use the term races and kinds here? When we're talking about a community that is articulated by the laws of Manu, of ancient Indian Sanskrit, of Vedic literature, which prescribes a caste society. And remember, you want to think about what caste society is. It's not a class society. And to some degree, it's not an estate It's not society either. Because in the caste society, one is born into groupings, one belongs to them by birth, and those groupings not only give you a certain kind of occupation, but we're not talking about different economic occupations, right? One of the occupations would be to be a priest. That is, to have any kind of access to religious texts, religious teachings, and to preside over religious rituals. Another caste would be those who, in a sense, are rulers, another who are warriors, another who are the tradespeople or agriculturists, farmers and the like, the sudras. Right? And then bound up with each of these caste distinctions is, rigid separations regarding who you can socialize with, who you can eat with, who you can marry. Right? All of these things are determined in this way where different rules pertain to these different groupings, all of which are rooted in something given by nature, in the sense that you are born into these groupings. And this is to provide for, in a sense, what a certain kind of community needs. All of its necessary functions whereby it can reproduce itself are accounted for. Now Nietzsche points out that this caste society also has another category, the chandalas. Who are the chandalas?
They're the lowest class, right?
Well, in a sense, they're not even a caste. They're the outcasts, really. They're the untouchables. They don't fit into the society in any way. They don't have any sanctioned role. They're outside of it. And as outside of it, they are subject to, various kinds of prohibitions that pretty much are a recipe for their destruction, as he recounts. Now, in speaking about this kind of humanity, he characterizes it as Aryan humanity. After all, these were the Aryans who invaded northern India, subordinated the existing population. You know, the Indian word, or the Sanskrit word for caste is actually varna, which also means color. So there's some sense that there's a kind of racial divide in the caste structure where the southerners who were darker than the invading Aryans were the ones who ended up being on either chandalas or sudras, on the bottom end of things. But anyway, we're talking about a kind of society where we have natural differences being associated with privileges. And in a sense, everything to which one could be said to have a role in is dictated by these determinations. Christianity is opposed to this. And in being opposed to this, Christianity is against allowing natural differences to dictate the organization of humanity. And in repudiating that in its totality, Christianity is, in a sense, embracing a part of the Aryan humanity. What part is Christianity, in effect, embracing? Well, Nietzsche says it's embracing the chandalas. It's embracing the outcasts. Because what it is doing is overturning this natural order, which respects natural differences, which respects particularity, which doesn't allow for any universal norms. Because each caste has its own particular norms that are rooted in its own particular character. But the anti-natural morality of the tamers of these natural differences is in effect the morality that is going to favor the chandalas. So you ask yourself, how are we to regard what Nietzsche would be providing for? Is he upholding a caste community? Is that what, in a sense, is the positive alternative to his unmasking of the anti-nature morality typified by Christianity? And as we'll see, that anti-nature morality is not just typified by Christianity. It's typified by modern democracy. It's typified by socialism. All of these are going to be, in a sense, forms of Chandala morality. Now again, we want to ask, well, what is the nature of the critique, and how does that critique uphold any positive alternative, and on what basis? Is that positive alternative going to be a reaffirmation of a caste humanity founded on natural differences? Note, of course, that Nietzsche, as has been noted, will make remarks about women in distinction from men. That's another natural difference. And to regard the natural difference of male and female as determinative in a way that bears upon values is, again, associated with all of this. Well, we want to see where all this goes. Next time we'll pursue it a little farther. We'll go to those four errors he speaks of and see to what degree the whole argument can hold itself up.